Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and we're on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, July 20th, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Dan Dooling and William Rapkin. First up is Dan Dooling. Dan earned his PhD in drama from the University of Texas, Austin. His plays have been produced throughout the U.S. and honored with a number of awards, including the Oregon Playwrights Award for Stranglehold. His writing for television, film, and new media has included work for Oregon Public Broadcasting, MTV, Nickelodeon, and Comedy Central. The feature film Last Lives, based on his screenplay, originally premiered on the Sci-Fi Channel and is available on DVD. He's a former journalist. He also writes fiction. He has a short story in Orange County Noir, along with me. He's here this morning to primarily talk about his job as scriptwriter for Pageant of the Masters in Laguna Beach. Hey, Dan.
Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. So glad to have you on.
And it's always a pleasure.
Before we go on and talk about the nitty-gritty of writing for the pageant, will you tell the listeners who don't know what Pageant of the Masters is, what it is?
Okay. This is the dilemma that's faced me as long as I've been there, and that is trying to explain to someone who hasn't seen the pageant what it is. Imagine a beautiful outdoor amphitheater 6 blocks from the beach in Laguna Beach, where in the evening you sit under the stars and watch stage illusions created on stage of masterpieces of art recreated with people costumed and made up. It's a stage tradition called tableau vivant, which is literally living pictures of artworks recreated with an orchestra playing music written for each of the tableaus that you would see during a performance, and there would be about 40 of them in a 90-minute show. You're going to the theater in an outdoor amphitheater, but it is a very fun show for a general audience. It's a great date night. It's a great time to bring the family. It's exciting to see kids get excited about theater and art, and it's includes live narration performed every night by a wonderful actor by the name of Richard Doyle, a founding member of South Coast Repertory. And all I can tell you is that the sum of those parts and that strange conceit of creating living recreations of artworks somehow becomes very magical in the hands of the amazing artists working behind the scenes at the Pageant of the Masters, and director Diane Challis-Davies' continual inspiration to make the show more exciting each year. People come from all over, and we perform every night from now through August 31st, and we open back on the 7th of July. And until you see it, you really can't understand how special the pageant is. And I've gotten down to the point now where I just say, you really have to see it to and see how much fun it is. And I love the fact that we create a celebration of art that really says art has a place in all of our lives. And
yeah,
that's the best plug I can do.
Yeah, no, it's great. My son Travis and I went the other night. We brought my cousin Johnny and his wife Joan from Florida, who'd never seen it and had no idea what they were getting into. And they just absolutely loved it as well. And Travis and I were talking, we were all talking actually afterward, and we were curious about a few things. And one was this year's theme, Partners, included so many artists and paintings of particular interest to us. And so we were wondering what came first, the theme of Partners or the paintings and art you wanted to include that you had to find a theme for.
This was a tricky one. I knew about the theme when director Diane Challis-Davies basically said that's what the theme will be. This was about a year and a half ago. And as we were putting last year's pageant up, I was already starting to collect ideas with the theme in mind. And all the pageants since she became director begin with the announcement of the theme, or at least the unofficial beginnings of our research together. Then in September and October, she and I would start putting things up on the wall and reorganizing them. And there was a huge pile of things that ended up on the, shall we say, the cutting room floor, things that I was really passionate about that didn't get in, things that we both agreed would work in a later show but weren't going to fit this time. We're always looking for new things that we've never done, or if we're doing an artist whose work we've celebrated before, new artworks that we have not done as tableaus in the past. And so it is very exciting for me in September and October. It really feels like one of those true partnerships where Diane and I basically are conceiving how to make this into a show and really looking at the perception of what works best in the first act, how we end act one in a finale that makes people want to come back for act two, how we can open act two with as much excitement as possible, and since 1936, how we're going to treat The Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci, which is the traditional finale since 1936. And as soon as she announced that partners would be the theme, I immediately thought of something I've been passionate about for a number of years since I became the sort of unofficial historian at the pageant, and that was to celebrate the wife of Roy Ropp, who is generally regarded as the father of the Pageant of the Masters, and give her equal billing and say, let's give props to Marie Ropp, because she wrote the original narration, she chose the music that was performed live, she helped with the design and costumes and the shape of the show, and you just know that it was a collaboration which I would parallel in some ways with the way that Diane and I work together. I guess I would be Marie to her Roy, but the point being that as a writer, if I have anything that I particularly love to do with the pageant, it is to find women artists who have either been underappreciated or ignored or forgotten and give them their due. And whenever I can do that, as I get to do a few times in this year's show, that's just a double reward for me. It's not like a hidden agenda. It's just a pleasure, an extra pleasure for me. And I think Dee appreciates that as well. And so we then come up with a show that we can imagine from beginning to end, and then we really need to know the sequence of it and the timings of it, because then we start, you know, when production begins in earnest in January, with the initial meetings with our six composers who are assigned different pieces, and we want to work intimately with them to make sure that their music will fit with the narration and complement the approach not only to the theme but to that individual piece, and bring as much musical variety as we search for artistic variety into a show that really spans the gamut. There's nothing that's off the table other than the fact that it has to have recognizable human figures in the artworks. And even then, we'll try when we can to find something with a little more abstraction in it. There's a piece by Cézanne called The Bathers in this year's show that is fairly abstract. It was early modern experiments with something that was more impressionistic, but more a bit more abstract as well. But on our stage, it looks, I think, particularly wonderful, just in keeping with the story that we were telling at that point.
But yeah, that was beautiful. I had a hard time. We always bring binoculars, of course, and I had a very hard time trying to figure out the humans. You know, it was beautiful. It was just gorgeous. But before we go on, let me say that you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here this morning with Dan Dooling, who's the scriptwriter for Pageant of the Masters, among other things. And the opinions and views that you hear on the show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. You know, you're giving a ton of props to everyone associated with the pageant, but I want to give you props, because one of the things I love about going to the pageant is hearing your script, your commentary. You're so witty and interesting, and coupled with the paintings and the artists, it can be quite moving. And so I was wondering, as I was getting weepy during the pageant on Saturday night, if you feel those moments when it's going to make viewers like me weepy. I mean, are you writing it to sort of the way you might write a play with sort of a dramatic arc? Are you paying attention to that?
Do you? Absolutely. But I mean, I sit there and I get weepy at the moments in the show that moved me when I was researching them and looking for the way in which I can convey that simply, but you know, the music helps a great deal to draw you into those moments. But it's really thinking, as a playwright, I like to think, hearing the way storytelling coupled with music and a visual will draw you in and just create an impression or a feeling that is stronger and deeper than any one of those elements just by itself. Looking at a painting in a museum, you invest it with whatever you bring to your awareness of or appreciation for that artist, what they went through, what the piece means to you and how it speaks to you. We sort of are looking for ways to, without being overly manipulative, really just sharing our appreciation, and in many cases, my personal appreciation for an artist. And one of the things that Diane Challis Davie, as director, I think has appreciated is the importance and value of story. I think when you look at the piece, if there isn't, the story gives you that additional deepening of the relationship with what's on there. I'm curious what made you weepy, because I have moments where it's hard not to tear up pretty much every night. I definitely am an empath, and you know, coming from my acting background, I suppose, as well, just I feel the show, and if I can feel it, I'm hoping the audience feels it as well.
Well, I'll tell you one, and that was the bit with Carl Larson. I think that was his first name, the painter.
Yes.
And you know, the big family, the Scandinavian art, and there was a line, something like, love is the solution to the puzzle of life or something. And
that is the quote, and that is from Carl Larson. And we had a guest actor recorded who is Swedish, and so it's coming through not as a polished performer saying it, but really as someone with a Swedish accent just saying it with not a great deal of emotional embellishment, but with the music and with hopefully the way we've led up to it, it's a beautiful quote, and in that context and what you've been looking at, I think it's one of the, you know, economies of what I have to do. So much of my work and the challenge of it is finding ways to distill really the essence of a point that we want to make. I think when I first started, I was so keenly aware of everything that was being left on the cutting room floor that it was hard for me to see that really what I have to do is pick my battles very carefully, pick my moments very carefully, and then crystallize them to have hopefully the maximum impact with the right amount of subtlety. I mean, if we get bombastic or if we get pretentious, if we get didactic, none of those things will help the audience engage with art that we want them to see really can speak to all of us. And so each piece in the, you know, there are roughly 40 artworks, but let's say there are 20 moments and 20 different artists during the show, I'm looking at each one of them as a little mini playlet as much as possible. And sometimes I have more opportunity, sometimes very little, but each time there is a specific goal that we're looking for. And then when we have a script that the director and I both agree is ready to go to the narrator, he'll do a demo, which we'll then give to the composer so they can score directly to it. And it is a kind of still remarkable to me that things that we came up with back in September, October of last year, we're now watching come to fruition this summer every night. and be remarkably close, hopefully, to what we originally intended. There, of course, with live theater, there's always the chance that there can be things that don't work out quite the way they do, but given as ambitious as this show is, I wouldn't still be enthused and involved with it, I don't think, as much if it weren't done on such a professional level. And, I'm proud of what I can do as a playwright working in a unique performance environment, creating narration for it. But I'm even more proud, I think, of the vision of the show, the inclusiveness of the show, and the fact that we're seeing our audiences getting younger and more diverse. And that's exciting to me, because I want, as does our director, as everybody involved, really, for this to be a show that speaks to a 21st century audience, not a museum piece, not an anachronism from an earlier time. We respect tradition, but we're really dedicated to making the arts hopefully as accessible and, if anything, more moving to a contemporary audience. And
yeah.
You've seen what we did this year to try to offer them opportunities for engagement on whatever level they were comfortable with. And for me, it always comes from story, but there are places where it's important to let our union orchestra really shine, and our composers have their moments, and then our amazing designers and painters and costumers, who are as good as anybody working in the business, show off their skills as stage magicians. And somehow all of that comes together in a very short period of time at the end of a rehearsal and construction period, basically from January through June. And then when we open in July, as soon as I've seen it with a few paying audiences, I really feel like I can be comfortable with where the show is and how much we were able to accomplish. That said, director Chalice Davy is fine-tuning the show still trying to make little adjustments, little tweaks to make it just that much tighter, that much more cohesive. But in terms of the narrative connectivity, which I consider my major task and challenge, I feel very good about this year's overall ability to tell some great stories. And then, like you, and I suspect everyone, they'll have their favorites, and I had a number of favorites this year.
Yeah, I think, maybe I say this every year, but the show, I think, was my favorite yet. And I've seen quite a few of them. And I just found every little bit just so interesting and wonderful, and love being exposed to artists I'd never heard of, like Larson or Marie Anne and Antoine was another.
Lavoisier, yes.
I loved
Marie
that.
Is the artist, Lavoisier is the chemist.
Yes.
Together, we wouldn't know about the father of modern chemistry, Antoine Lavoisier, if it weren't for his wife's dedication, her artistry, her knowledge of languages, her gifts on many different levels, which gave us a record, a clear and accurate record of his discoveries, and kept his legacy alive after, and this is not a spoiler alert thing, but it's just a shocking reality that when the French Revolution took place, both her father and her husband were implicated as basically tax collectors for the crown, and were both executed within 5 minutes of one another on the guillotine, while Marie was imprisoned herself. She was ultimately released, but then it became her challenge to maintain his legacy and make sure that his other works were published, and basically assure with her documentation of their experiments that his legacy would not be forgotten. And I didn't know the Lavoisier story. I think Dan Charles maybe would tell you that finding that story was one of the things that really moved her when she was thinking about partners. It was a story we had not told before in the pageant, and a fairly involved one and tricky one, but I liked the way that it ultimately came out, and we massaged it a great deal in the preparing, and then Richard does a wonderful reading of the story, which gives the audience room to invest in just the nature of the marital partnership, the scientific partnership, the artistic partnership involved. And then if you look through the gallery of pieces in the show, really you're getting some great classic familiar partnerships like Lewis and Clark or the Wright brothers, but you're also getting I think some more interesting takes. I always like to find the elasticity in the theme and expand it to an artist with a patron or an artist with a muse, or in some cases for me I loved being able to make the connection that David Hockney's art was so dramatically influenced by his move to Los Angeles, and so I saw it as a partnership between an artist and literally the city that became his muse. And so it's fun coming up with those conceptual ideas, but it still ultimately comes down to the vividness of the artistic illusions, the intimacy of the music and the appropriateness of it, and how it hopefully enhances Richard Reed's and the overall shape of the show. This was a fun show, I have to say, and for Diane Chalice Davy, I know that one of the things that she really wanted to celebrate and that Mark Partners probably mostly generated from was the idea of great dance partners, and specifically the legacies of Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly in the movies.
Yes.
And so a great deal of the show is devoted to celebrations of dance in art, dance in the movies, and those two extraordinary performers and their extraordinary dance partners. The old saying used to be, or the comic line was, Ginger Rogers had to do everything Fred Astaire had to do. She just had to do it backwards and in high heels. And, that to me is another way of saying we sometimes know the person who got the majority of the credit, but there oftentimes is, in that classic cliche, someone behind them that makes it possible. And that is another essential truism of Partners, that art does not happen in a vacuum, that the image of the tortured artist living in a garret, basically all alone, creating these artworks that no one may ever see or no one may ever buy, that is a part of the artistic experience that people relate to. But in reality, we are a community of human beings, and part of that artistic process is the people who buy our work, the people who support us, the people who make it possible. And I can celebrate that because I work with people who, including our amazing volunteers, who inspire me every day with their extraordinary commitment to the show.
Well, on that note, Dan, we have to go, but maybe we can continue
wow,
this.
We just got started.
I know, we just got started. I should have had you for the whole hour, huh? Maybe we can do a few more questions on the blog later.
That'd be great.
So thank you so much. And I'm going to say more about the pageant at the end of the show, but you can find it at pageantofthemasters.com. Thank you, Dan.
That's a pleasure, Barbara. And, I hope you'll come back next summer, and I hope that audiences will come out and join us at the pageant this summer.
Thank you. That was Dan Dooling, scriptwriter for Pageant of the Masters. When we come back, we should have William Rapkin with us. Don't go away.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you. top of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world. Stay all night and play with my TV. TV is the thing this year. TV is the thing this year. Radio is great, but it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. Last night I was watching old Tom Mix. My TV broke and I was in a fix. I got on the phone, I called my man and said, get here, Daddy, as fast as you can. TV is the thing this year. TV is the thing this year. Radio is great, but it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. Yeah, TV is the thing this year. TV is the thing this year. Radio is
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. during the first half. I was here with Dan Dooling, and I am back with William Rapkin. Before we bring him on, before I introduce him, let me say that you can find KUCI on Twitter at KUCIFM, on Instagram at KUCIFM, and on Facebook at KUCI889. And this show will join the other shows on my website, penonfire.com, in the next week or so, so that if you missed part of it, or you didn't hear the first half at all, or you get to the end of this show, well, you wouldn't know that right now, right? If you get to the end of this show and you didn't hear it all. If you want to hear it again, you can find it on my website. Let's bring on William Rapkin. He is, he's written or produced more than 300 hours of television drama, including a dozen pilots. He served as showrunner on two network series. He's developed and written TV shows and movies in China and Germany and has consulted with writers, producers, and executives in Brazil, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden. He created the screenwriting curriculum for the University of California, Riverside, Palm Desert's Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing and Writing for the Performing Arts, where he continues to teach. And he is an associate professor of television writing and producing at Long Island University's TV Writers Studio MFA program. He's the author of the best-selling book, Writing the Plot, which is the primary focus of our conversation today. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Barbara.
Thank you for coming on. I wonder if we could begin with hearing you talk a little bit about writing the pilot and how the book came about.
The book came out about 5 years ago. I was teaching at UC Riverside, and I noticed that what had been almost entirely students interested in writing screenplays were turning more and more towards television as the writing in movies got less interesting for writers and the writing on television was becoming more and more interesting, and a lot of them want to write pilots. And I was looking for a resource to turn to because they were making a lot of mistakes in writing pilots, and there was none. And I was just absolutely shocked. So I just searched Google and searched Amazon to make sure that this book didn't exist and said, I have to write it.
Hmm. That's usually the reason, isn't it? There's not, you need to write something that just hasn't been done or hasn't been done in the way that you need it to be done.
Yes, and it was really fascinating for me because, you know, I had written a bunch of pilots, but never had had a reason to formalize my thoughts on how pilots work. It was very instinctual. As you know, most creative writers write first instinctually and then maybe later go back and intellectualize what the process was. So it forced me to confront what made a pilot work and what made a pilot not work, and that was really a fascinating process for me to go through.
Well, you know, I think it's surprising to writers in other genres when they come to writing for TV or become interested in writing for TV, how much planning needs to happen before the actual writing of a script. Whereas, you know, as you said, in other forms, writing a novel, short story, you don't necessarily have to plan out in the same way or certainly not to the depth that you do for a TV script.
No, in fact, I work with so many great novelists and poets and essayists at UC Riverside, and for most of them, you know, the thought of that kind of planning is just absolutely counter to what they think makes for good writing. You know, it's about instinct and following that the vision wherever it's going to take you. And yes, in television, so much of what we do is planning, and especially in writing a pilot. Because unlike a novel or even a screenplay, a pilot is not simply a story told start to end. It has to feel like a story, and ideally a series, say a series like Breaking Bad, will seem like it is a continuing storyline. But actually, it's not. It's a set of discrete episodes, each of which exists to reiterate a series of themes through a series of conflicts. So you're designing not just characters and plot and incidents, you're really designing a machine that can continue to self-replicate over the next, you know, 10 or 20 or ideally 100 episodes.
So how much then does a writer of a pilot need to know about his or her show? And in other words, when you're writing the pilot, do you only need to know about the arc of the show, the season, or do you need to know the overall arc of the series when in fact there may not even be a series, right? I mean, because the pilot, if the pilot isn't picked up, then there's nothing.
True. And this is the crazy contradiction about writing a pilot, because you really do have to know where you're going, at least in a very general idea. So you're planning on all these great things that you're going to do down the line, but then, of course, there is no down the line, especially if you're writing a spec pilot. All you have is this 60 pages, which are going to convince somebody or not. And in my consulting work, working with writers trying to get pilots going, you know, they're always saying, oh, yes, and I have this great character who's going to come up in episode 6 or episode 10. I have this great twist for the end of the season. And I always say, no, bring it in earlier. You've got to bring it into the pilot, because the pilot has to sell us on your entire vision and yet still somehow be able to hold things back for later. To me, the core of the pilot is what we call the franchise, which is the set of, you know, identifying elements that define a show. And in writing the pilot, I gave a long list of what those elements were. And this is sort of the one part of that book that I've always been uncomfortable with, because it's like somebody asking you what an elephant is, and you say, oh, it's a trunk, and it's ears, and it's tail. You know, it's all true, but it's not actually a definition. And I'm writing a sequel to this, which should be out in the fall, and really want to focus on what the franchise is. To me, the franchise is the three elements that define what the series is. It's the concept, the central conflicts, and the theme. And those are the three controlling entities that define everything that's going to happen. And that's what you need to know going into writing your pilot, not so much the incidents that are going to happen down the line, but these elements that are going to control everything that does happen.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with William Rapkin. His book is called Writing the Pilot. So is the same amount of planning necessary if you're writing a screenplay for a feature film?
I don't think so. And I certainly don't mean any disrespect to feature writers, because that is a very difficult but very different craft, even though it looks the same. Because a screenplay is a story. You know, the beginning, middle, and end, and it needs to have a conflict that can sustain 90 minutes or 2 hours. When you're writing a pilot, you need to create conflicts that can be interestingly resolved within the 60 minutes you have, but also that then can keep being replayed over and over and over again. So you're really designing a template as much as you're designing a story. I find that's much more difficult. And I mean, it is a tremendously difficult form of writing, so much that you see great writers who have had successful shows on the air before fail more often than they succeed, simply because it's so hard to get all those pieces to work together.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of which then, in terms of screenwriting, it would seem to me, or at least what I gather, is that if you're interested in really pursuing screenwriting, that TV writing is the way to go, despite its difficulty, rather than feature films, because feature films are going, or have been going, more in a direction of the blockbuster, or what would play to, say, an international audience, as opposed to sort of a story with characters and you know, plots and subplots.
Yes, and it depends what kind of writing you really want to do. I mean, if you are born to write studio blockbusters, if you feel a great pull towards writing, you know, Marvel superhero movies, and honestly, it probably helps if you're a white guy who's 25, and therefore can get into the room to pitch those jobs. You know, if that's what you want and that's who you are, you should go for it. But if you're interested in more character-based storytelling and in more thoughtful storytelling, right now there's a lot more room for that in television.
Well, and you just mentioned, you know, if you're a white guy around 25, it may be easier to get in the room. What about ageism and sexism in Hollywood in regards to TV writers? Are there opportunities for the older writer, for the woman writer, as there are for men in TV writing?
There are opportunities. You know, everything, the whole business is designed to say no to as many people as possible, because there are so many more people who want to be in it than whom it can accommodate. So everything, almost everything, becomes another obstacle you have to get past. And I think the obstacles, one obstacle is age. You know, I'm no longer in my 20s or 30s or even 40s. And, you know, I'm the old guy. That's a problem for me. It's harder, I'm sure, in most instances, if you're a woman, if you're a minority. It's not impossible. It's not 1962 where everybody is going to look like Don Draper. And now there are more opportunities, I think, opening up. I think there really is consciousness that diversity is a good thing, that diversity can actually help bring in an audience. You know, you look at what Shonda Rhimes has done, just opening up doors in the one way that the industry understands, which is by making them money. And there is a great interview with Aline Brosh McKenna and Rachel Bloom, who created Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, who have a very diverse writing staff. And they sat down with John August and Craig Mazin for their podcast and talked about just having a diverse crew around you opens up so many doors for storytelling, because there's so many different experiences that people have had that they can bring into this mix. And it feels like that is beginning to sort of bubble through parts of the business. But, you know, as in, I think, just about any business right now, it's always still somewhat harder. How much harder it is, I can't tell you.
I've heard that contests are a great way to get noticed, that if you write a script and you, that there's a number of really good contests to submit to, that you win a prize or you're a, you know, first, second place runner up, that might be a way to get in. What do you think?
I've been watching a couple of my students make their way through both the contest world and the blacklist world, which is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Had a recent graduate from UCR, brilliant young writer, just started on the faculty at DePaul, which I think is terrific. And she came in, I think, second in five major contests, and she was part of one admission to the Meryl Streep program out in New York for women writers over 40. And she has met people based on that. It's not a ticket anywhere. None of these things are ever a ticket anywhere, unfortunately, but it brought her access. So she's had chances to talk to some directors who might be interested in her project. She's talked to managers and agents. It's a way of opening the door. I think a lot of people who enter contests think, I win this, and now I have my deal, and now I'm in the business. And it's not quite like that. But, you know, certainly winning some of the prestigious contests can start opening doors for you.
Mm-hmm. I am talking to William Rapkin. We have a few minutes left. We're talking about his book, Writing the Pilot, and about TV writing in general. And what about And one thing I got from your book is, you know, the most, perhaps the most important element of your script are the characters. And I don't know that TV writers might think that plot is more important or conflict, both of which are important, but talk about the characters.
Well, the characters are really what bring people back week after week. You know, you audiences fall in love with TV characters and want to see what's going to happen to them week after week. But my own philosophy is that TV characters are inseparable from the plot, from the story, I should say. So that, you know, Walter White is probably the most famous and beloved character in recent television, the hero or anti-hero of Breaking Bad, the high school chemistry teacher who is diagnosed with terminal cancer and decides to start making meth to protect his family. And, you know, Walter White, taken out of that context, you know, if we jump back a year in Walter White's life, so he was just a burned-out high school chemistry teacher who was working at the car wash to help pay the bills, he would be a terrible lead for a show. I mean, yeah. even if you still have Bryan Cranston playing him, it would just be the most depressing show in history. But you take this character and you put him in the context of this criminal world, and you see how he operates there, and suddenly he's fascinating. You know, we are drawn to these characters who make choices, who do things, and we are drawn by their inner conflicts and you know, the conflicts they create for themselves. I mentioned the show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It is my current favorite thing. I think I went through all 18 episodes in about 3 days last week. And, you know, here is this character who she starts off as a young New York lawyer, very unhappy, very workaholic. She's just about to be promoted to partner because she's never missed a day of work, right? She, like, works 24 hours a day. She has no life. She runs into this guy she had a summer fling with at summer camp when she was 16, who lives in West Covina, and decides at that moment she is giving up her life in New York and moving to West Covina, though not to be with him, she tells herself. Again, if we joined her a year before that show starts, even with all her wonderful songs, I don't think we'd care that much about her, because we've seen tortured young lawyers living that awful life before. It's the fact that she has made this choice and she is chasing this ridiculous dream that just draws us to her and makes us keep watching to see whether she'll succeed or whether she'll ever really understand what it is she's doing. So character and story are, in television certainly, are completely inseparable.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I feel that way about The Walking Dead, because I'm not a zombie watcher, and yet I watched the pilot and I got involved with the main characters. And it pulled me through four seasons. I don't know. I'm not at the current season, but, you know, it's like it wasn't my kind of thing until the characters pulled me in. So it's interesting that you say that, because it's so true, so very true.
And yeah, you know, I agree with you on both counts. Never been a zombie person and fell in love with that show. Excuse me. And that brings in the other half of the dynamic and need for a character, because, you know, Walking Dead isn't just about zombies. It's really based on this very core theme, which is, you know, what defines humanity? Is surviving enough, you and your family surviving, or do you need to actually build society for everyone who can make it? Mm-hmm. And that's the struggle of that show. I mean, the zombies are just the excuse to have that fight. And there's always one person on one side of that saying, no, we got to kill all these guys. We don't trust them. We got to just keep moving, protect our own. And then somebody else says, no, we have to make something better out of this. And that kind of changes, you know, especially with Rick, is one guy for a long time, and then all of a sudden he's the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
But everything in the show comes down to that, and that's what keeps you watching. Like, how are we going to solve this problem? We can't.
Yeah, interesting. I'm so sorry we're at the end of our time. In another half hour that went just like that. In closing, do you have any advice for writers who want to write for TV?
It's just the same advice everyone would give them, which is just to keep writing, that you get better as you write. So be incredibly prolific and think through what you're doing, and don't stop, because nobody's going to stop to help you. You got to sort of push your way in.
Yeah, you got to be your own biggest advocate, huh?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Bill, for taking the time.
That was a great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. That was William Rapkin. His book is Writing the Pilot. And we're at the end of our time. It's unbelievable how quick this time goes. Anyway, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. And come back next week for more talk about words and books and writers and all sorts of great things. Thank you for listening.